Dinosaurs Invading the Workforce.
Oh, man, look at my life. I'm a lot like you.
I've got to come back, Sam.
Frank, Christ, you're a dinosaur.
Listen, I've got to be there.
Frank, at your age?
I've got at least one pair of good shoes in the back of the closet somewhere.
Aging workers with good shoes and a need to stay working may make it hard for younger workers trying to break into the job market. Older workers looking for jobs may keep the unemployment rate high long after the recession is over.
Oh man, take a look at my life. I'm a lot like you.
When dinosaurs rule the labor force, you got to watch out for Grampusaurus on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, September 4th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. This hour, we're going to take a look at the war within the Obama administration about how to fight the war in Afghanistan. Also go to the Mexican border for a ground-level report on alarming new drug violence there. And it's not exactly bikini weather yet, but the Arctic hasn't been this hot in 2,000 years. Some alarming new climate change data coming out of there.
But first, Catherine Rampell, editor of the New York Times economics blog. We talked there about older workers at the top. But when are we going to start seeing some permanent structural changes in the labor force reflected in our monthly unemployment statistics?
I think we're already seeing this. We have hugely high unemployment rates amongst younger workers. And what's making this the pattern worse, as you suggested before, is that you have a lot of people nearing retirement age who are counting on private savings. They have 401ks, they have IRAs, they have some other sort of alternative to a traditional corporate pension, which means that when the economy goes sour, so do their retirement savings, and so they're holding on to their jobs or they're re-entering the labor force at precisely the time when employers are trying to shrink their payrolls.
Which is bad timing. Thanks, Catherine Rampell, editor of the New York Times economics blog. Stay with us. First, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, there's been a massive explosion in Afghanistan. Nearly 100 are believed dead. A NATO airstrike on militants and hijacked fuel trucks sparked a giant fireball. Senior Taliban commanders are apparently among the dead. NATO's investigating reports of many civilian deaths. Afghan President Hamid Karzai is now launching a special investigation. Later this hour, UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown makes his case for British troops to continue the fight. British calls for a pullout are growing. Brown's coming speech will call for a troop presence until Afghan forces can fully manage security.
They're now calling it a murder scene, that wildfire around the Los Angeles area. Investigators now say the giant blaze is an arson homicide. Two firefighters died when their truck tumbled down a mountain. Fire is now 38% contained. It's been burning a week and a half, scorching more than 225 square miles. North Korea could have a new tool for making nuclear weapons. It says it's in the final stages of enriching uranium. It's already believed to have about a half dozen atom bombs made from plutonium enrichment. So we're waiting for unemployment numbers later on this morning. And Wall Street, which gained less than 1% yesterday, opens today. Dow at 93.45. The S&P starts trading just above 1,000 at 10.03. And the NASDAQ begins at 1983. Macroeconomic statistics and microeconomic statistics. What's going on in your job circle? Are you or your friends or family having luck finding jobs? Rob emails us. I'm a consultant who specializes in HR information systems. About 15 months ago, the number of projects dwindled to a handful, but in the last 3 weeks, I've been receiving lots of calls. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. We're going to get those August unemployment figures later on in this hour at 8:30. The Labor Department will tell us the unemployment rate for August. And anticipating them yesterday, Vice President Joe Biden sounded pretty darn optimistic.
Instead of talking about the beginning of a depression, we're talking about the end of a recession 8 months after taking office.
Economists expect those unemployment numbers to go from 9.4 to 9.5% when they're announced later this morning. But has the economy improved this summer? There are some indications that a bottom has been found in places like housing, perhaps unemployment. According to a new CNN poll, though, 9 out of 10 Americans think the economy is still mired in a recession. Bringing back Catherine Rampell this morning, who joins us for a preview of what those numbers might look like. Catherine edits the economics blog for our partners, the New York Times. And when we look at unemployment figures month to month, Catherine, there are those business cycle fluctuations. We've got seasonal fluctuations. Then there are these bigger changes that you referred to earlier that seem to be taking place. What should we be paying attention to?
Well, in terms of the longer-term trends, we've been seeing, partially as a result of the recession, that more women have been holding more of the jobs on companies' payrolls. We've been seeing more and more older workers staying in the labor force longer. That's sort of a longer-term trend that's been exacerbated, I would say, by the recession.
This Pew study that came out yesterday, we reported it, Celeste, suggests that over the next 10 years or so, 93% of the growth in the labor force is going to be among older workers mm-hmm. who need to keep working because their retirement situation is actually not terribly good.
Right.
And, you know, that's one trend. But what about jobs that you're seeing in the unemployment figures that are maybe not coming back in certain sectors? How does it break down?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. Certainly, we've lost a lot of jobs in manufacturing and in construction, and those are industries that are very cyclically sensitive. You know, they sort of lead us into recession, and sometimes they lead us out of recession. But there are obviously a lot of concerns among workers that those jobs will be placed elsewhere in the world as opposed to coming back, at least in their previous form, in the United States.
Now, if and everybody says that the unemployment rate is a lagging indicator, it's the last thing to improve mm-hmm. in a recession, right? And we're expected to see something on the order of 9.5% unemployment. If that's the case, where do you start looking for an actual turnaround where some of these cyclical sectors of the economy, like construction, mm-hmm. are going to actually start bouncing back?
Yeah, you look toward construction, housing, you know, how many homes are on the market, how many months' worth of inventory of houses are on the market, how much new building is going on, durable goods are sort of the earlier versions of products that people
are... washing machines, big appliances,
yeah.
Cars are durable goods.
Yeah. And
unless
so,
you buy a Fiat, I suppose.
Exactly.
Yeah, actually, that's a terrible thing to say.
That.
That's a terrible,
that's
thing,
a terrible
to
thing to say.
You
can
send your emails
now.
To John
yeah,
Hockenberry.
Right. Exactly. No. We love Fiats.
But generally, there are sort of ways to look at where products are in the pipeline, whether companies are rebuilding their inventories. If they're not getting a whole lot of orders, they might just be running right. down stock that they have in the back room. But at some point, you see them start to recharge their manufacturing process.
And that needs more jobs.
Exactly.
Finally,
a longer ways away.
Finally, if this CNN poll suggests that people are feeling the pain, 9 out of 10 say the recession is still around, does that mean people will continue to look for work, they'll stay measured as part of the unemployment rate, and that all those people looking for work because they're so concerned about getting a job will keep the unemployment rate high?
Not necessarily, actually. The way that the unemployment rate is measured, and this is technical, is that you have to be actively looking for work as well as wanting a job and available for a job. And a lot of people get discouraged. So if you stopped looking for work in the last 4 weeks, but you still want work, but, you know, you're not getting interviews.
You're not measured.
You know, yeah exactly. Mm-hmm. They say, okay, you're part of the discouraged workforce, but you don't actually factor into that official unemployment rate.
Well, discouraged or not, people are feeling the pain. Catherine Rampell, editor of the New York Times economics blog, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
So, John, you know, when you say 9 out of 10 people think we're still in a recession, that means it's not just unemployed people
right.
that are feeling like we're still in a recession. So we wanted to step away a little bit from some of the politicians who are already trying to take credit for the emergence from recession and hear from some people who are actually on the ground paying bills and paying mortgages and trying to find work and see how they're feeling. We're joined in the studio by Francine Morin. You are a hospital program coordinator. You were laid off in February. You're still unemployed.
Correct.
And we're also joined by Liz Gold. She's in Tampa, Florida, the mother of two and website manager for a Tampa Bay social networking site, momslikeme.com. Also, welcome back Cliff Hagedin. He's trucker and owner of Fort Gratiot Express Trucking. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Hi.
Francine,
good morning.
Let me start with you because you're one of these people who may be included in the count on unemployment numbers later today because you got laid off in February. It's now September.
Yeah.
Still unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
Are you actually getting interviews now, maybe, as opposed to when you first started looking?
I am actually getting calls, finally, after a long drought. And I have had a few interviews, including recently with the place that laid me off, with a completely different department.
Hmm. And these are in healthcare?
This is healthcare at a major teaching hospital here in New York City. It's easier for me to transition from one teaching hospital to another. At least that's what the HR reps are saying, because they say, you're fabulous.
That's positive. I wish
fabulous.
People would say I was fabulous. That's great, yeah.
John, you're fabulous.
Thank you.
Well, obviously the decision makers may be out with their kids or getting back to school, so hopefully the decision makers will be back in business by the middle of September, and I'll get more More calls and probably more decisions made. But I'm out there, and I do know that I have value as a worker.
Are you one of the 9 out of 10 who feels we're still in a recession, but you're optimistic?
I think we're actually getting out of the recession. Because of the fact that when I look online and I look at jobs that are appropriate to me, they're all of a sudden they're there, and they weren't for a while.
So
I've been able to just hit send when I wasn't able to do that for a really long time. The fact that my own place of work called me back for another position
is a
very good sign.
So, Liz, you're the mother of two, and you're getting ready to go back to school. What are you seeing from other parents who are trying to buy school supplies and handle the upcoming school year?
Well, actually, here in Florida, we've been back in school for about 2 weeks now. So our planning for purchasing school supplies and clothes and everything started in July. And that was definitely, in my opinion, when we were still very aware that we were in a recession. And I saw mom after mom on the website scouring all the deals, definitely cutting back. Myself, I actually send my daughter to a relatively inexpensive private school. And this year, rather than buying the school uniform shirts that the school sold for $15 each, I hunted and found, a cheaper deal on a plain polo, and then hired a mom on the website who does a little work from home now and then to sew the logo on the shirt. And so
nice.
I saved about
$7 or $8
per shirt by doing it that way. And that's something, as a full-time working mom, I would have never made time to do before. The company that actually owns MomsLikeMe.com, we went through
Gannett,
two different...
Right?
Yes, Gannett. We went through two different furloughs, one in the first quarter for the first for 5 days. So, we lost half a paycheck in the first quarter. And then we expected it in the second quarter, and that wasn't too big of a shock. And those were, just temporary pains in the budget.
But are you expecting another?
Well, actually, in the third quarter, they announced that they did pay cuts across the board
right.
for anyone that had not already taken a pay cut. So
you're still feeling the pain of the recession.
Absolutely. I took a 5% pay cut in the third quarter, and I'm in digital. I made the transition from news into digital, knowing that's where the media is going.
It's still hurting you. Cliff, you're out on the roads, a trucker and owner of Fort Gratiot Express. What are you seeing on the roads? Is there more traffic and more people delivering things?
Hi, Celeste. Definitely. I've been running so hard this week that, as they say, pedal to the metal, my foot has plumb gone right through to the radiator. I'm pushing so hard.
So
that's great news.
Yeah, that's good stuff, although I hope you're not exceeding the speed limit. Do you feel like you're seeing signs? Are you seeing definite signs, or is it just kind of a feeling in your gut that the recession may be coming to an end?
Oh, it's ended. And in fact, we're so strong that I predict that we'll hammer right out of this recession fast. I see trucks are stacked, not stacked on top of each other because one can barely get underneath an overpass as it is. But we are running convoys again, which means instead of 8-10 trucks in a row, I'm seeing 40 and 50 in a row.
Cliff Hagedin, trucker and owner of Fort Gratiot Express. We're also joined by Francine Morin, still looking for work, and Liz Gold, a mother of two, and the website manager for Tampa Bay's MomsLikeMe.com.
Here's a dog days of summer kind of story. Coming up, if the Arctic ice melts and is expected to do so in the next 15 to 30 years, that means there's a whole new ocean to sail on, not simply underneath. There's a race to the North Pole, and we're going to talk about it in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. So, Celeste, all aboard. Let's go.
Where?
Why, to the North Pole, of course. This is the Polar Express.
With the climate change clock ticking, there is quite literally a race on to the North Pole, with global warming predictions suggesting that polar ice may essentially vanish in the next 15 to 30 years. There is suddenly competition for what could become the last ocean frontier. We're joined this morning by Anthony Russell. He's a lieutenant commander in the United States Coast Guard and heads up communication for the Commandant of the Coast Guard. He's also just recently returned from a trip to the Arctic. Anthony Russell, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, John. Thanks for having us.
So let's talk, first of all, about this report that was published in the journal Science yesterday that suggests that the Arctic is as warm as it's been in 2,000 years. You just visited the Arctic. What signs are there that that is indeed the case?
Well, I haven't read that report, but I can tell you that the Arctic is heating up twice as fast as the rest of the world. And 2007 and 2008 were both record low years for the sea ice coverage. So what we're seeing from the Coast Guard perspective is basically more water, more operating water up there that we haven't seen before, and we're responsible for making sure we can execute our missions there.
Is there
so we took a trip.
Is there a competition? Is there a competition, and does the U.S. need to get on top of this sort of scramble for the Arctic, and how, where do we stand on that?
Well, the reality is, you know, those are U.S. territorial waters and exclusive economic zones that we have sovereign responsibilities and obligations to protect, to provide for safety, security, and stewardship of those waters. As activities go on and increase in terms of shipping, ecotourism, energy exploration, fishing, we need to be thinking now how we're going to manage those increasing activities going forward in the future. And we need to do that in a cooperative fashion, both domestically, across our government, and internationally with the other Arctic nations.
So, Anthony Russell, take a listen to this. This is actually from some YouTube video that we pulled, which is actually made by the U.S. Coast Guard. Listen to this. Here's the sound of a Coast Guard cutter ramming the ice in late August of this year. What are you seeing when this is going on?
Well, one of the things to understand as we think about diminishing sea ice is it doesn't mean the ice is going away. It just means there's less of the seasonal ice. But there's still significant ice flows up there that create navigational hazards so that any shipping traffic that goes on up there, you know, they're going to be potentially at risk of having an incident with that. And we're going to have to be in a position to provide search and rescue support, environmental response, and things of that nature. I can tell you as a cutterman who's spent a lot of time at sea, those sounds aren't what you would normally hear down in the Caribbean where I've operated. So it shows you the harshness of that climate.
So, Anthony Russell, you have made other trips to the Arctic. I mean, what we're really talking about is climate change is probably causing the Arctic to heat up. Melting ice, it means larger chunks are loose and breaking up and more water. Is it looking substantially different now? I mean, are we actually seeing the higher temperatures change the landscape of the Arctic?
You are. While we were on our trip last week, 2 weeks ago, we went to the town of Shishmaref, which is basically eroding on both sides. And one of the causes believed to be causing that is the shorter periods of seasonal ice, which normally serves as kind of a shield for that that town. With less ice, the waves are able to spend a lot more time eating away at the island and creating a problem where they actually are beginning to consider whether or not they need to move the entire community.
Wow. Joining us now is Janos Pastor, who's director of the United Nations Secretary General's Climate Change Support Team. He joins us from Geneva. Mr. Pastor, you accompanied the Secretary General on this trip this week to the Arctic to look at climate change issues. First of all, what did you see? And secondly, what is the UN's role if nations in the Northern Hemisphere start scrambling for territorial waters that are suddenly opened up by climate change?
Good morning. And indeed, I was with the Secretary General earlier this week up at 81, 82 degrees north, seeing the diminishing ice. And the role of the Secretary General here is in particular to bring global attention to the problem that is caused by climate change, and who is better placed than the Secretary General of the United Nations to bring this message to the rest of the world. While we were there, of course, we spoke with scientists and we heard some of the latest data, the latest information about the environmental impact, but also about the geopolitical impacts that one can expect with the opening up of the northern shipping routes that will bring some very, very tremendous geopolitical implications, not just on the countries the Nordic countries that are around the Arctic, but on the rest of the world too.
Janosch Pastor, both of you, Janosch and Anthony Russell, I would suspect, would attest that the Arctic is a very, very beautiful place. But are we looking, first Janosch and then Anthony, at some tough conflict over sea lanes if things don't get nailed down in some sort of an agreement early on, Janosch?
Well, there is a UN convention on the law of the sea, and at least for those countries that have signed it, that are signatories, that applies, and at least there is a context within which one can deal with some of those issues. There are, of course, some countries who have not signed that treaty, and for them that remains an issue.
Anthony Russell, take us out. Is there the potential for conflict with the Russians and other nations over sea lanes in the Arctic if we don't get started on making agreements?
Well, it is our position that the United States should ratify the Convention on the Law of the Seas to avoid those conflicts and to provide an international method to resolve those disputes and improve our ability to work cooperatively to manage the issues going on in the Arctic region. Like you said, the Arctic is beautiful, and I think for the United States, the Arctic is actually a national treasure, but it's a vulnerable one, and we need to work together to protect it.
Well, both of our guests are working to protect that Arctic region. Anthony Russell is Lieutenant Commander for the U.S. Coast Guard and Press Secretary to the Commandant of the Coast Guard. And Janosch Pastor is the Director of the United Nations Secretary General's Climate Change Support Team. He traveled with U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to the Arctic. Thanks to you both. And now, let's take a look at some of the headlines we're following this morning.
Senior presidential advisors are split over whether to send more troops to Afghanistan. That comes around the same time as a NATO attack on a pair of fuel tankers hijacked by the Taliban. President Hamid Karzai says he's creating a panel to investigate today's attack. They say it killed 90 people. Americans with relatives in Cuba can now send them unlimited cash and visit the island for as long and as often as they want. This comes months after President Obama said he would ease the nearly five-decade-long trade embargo with Cuba. And in China, police used tear gas to break up crowds marching on Communist Party offices in the west of the country. The protesters want more public security following a series of unusual syringe stabbings that appeared ethnically motivated.
Detained opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi will be allowed to appeal her conviction. The pro-democracy leader in Myanmar or Burma was sentenced to serve an additional 18 months of house arrest after an uninvited American stayed at her home. And Eagles quarterback Michael Vick will be playing football later this month instead of having to wait until October. Vic missed two seasons while serving an 18-month prison sentence for operating a dogfighting ring. And those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
Well, we talked about NATO's attack on fuel tankers in Afghanistan that killed at least 90 people. We're going to have more on that story in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headley. Just out this morning from the Labor Department, the unemployment rate for August jumping from 9.4% to 9.7%. That's a little higher than expected. We'll have more on those numbers later on in the program. We reported earlier this week of a serious bombing that the Taliban has taken responsibility for in Afghanistan and claimed the life of a deputy intelligence minister. Well, it apparently hasn't taken long for NATO to respond. We were joined this morning by Chris Morris, BBC correspondent in Kabul, Afghanistan, and we asked him if there was any dispute over civilian versus militant casualty numbers in those attacks.
Yeah, there certainly is. I mean, the some of the facts aren't in dispute. Two fuel tankers were hijacked by the Taliban last night. We're told that two of the drivers were reported to have been beheaded. Late at night, in the early hours of the morning here, the tankers were observed on the banks of the Kunduz River. That's up in northern Afghanistan. And that's when an airstrike was ordered by NATO-led forces here. After that, the reports start to diverge. NATO said they were pretty confident that there were only insurgents in the area. But reports we're getting from local people, an MP in the area who's spoken to the villagers in that region, says he believes that maybe 40 to 60 insurgents were killed, including senior Taliban commanders. But there were maybe 20 or 30 civilians, local villagers who'd gathered around to try and get some fuel from the tankers, who were probably killed when the attack took place as well. And certainly the main hospital up in Kunduz, up in the north there, is getting a lot of civilians in with very bad burn injuries.
Well, Chris Morris, BBC correspondent in Kabul, we're hearing that Gordon Brown is going to officially maintain the UK troop presence in NATO in Afghanistan. There's, of course, a spirited debate in the United States over whether to increase troops in Afghanistan. What are you hearing in Afghanistan? Do the people in that country expect there to be an escalation, that these kind of attacks will continue with more troops coming in?
You know, I think the debate about more foreign troops is largely one being had outside the country. I mean, if you ask most people here, they don't want any foreign troops here in an ideal world, and I guess that would be the same for most countries. But there is real concern about the way the Taliban insurgency seems to be spreading. You mentioned the big Taliban suicide bomb attack earlier in the week, which killed the deputy head of national intelligence. It seems to be showing they're getting more sophisticated. So I think the short answer is, from here, if it worked, if more troops came here and it really did provide more security, then I think Afghan people would welcome it. But they're very skeptical. And I guess attacks like this, where they hear reports of civilians being killed in an international airstrike, makes them more skeptical still.
Well, certainly the skepticism is not confined to Afghanistan. That's Chris Morris, BBC correspondent in Kabul, reporting on the attack by NATO of two fuel tankers hijacked by the Taliban, killing civilians apparently and some Taliban militants.
Well, we have been hearing a lot of talk this week about changing strategies in Iraq and in Afghanistan, excuse me. And yesterday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates had this to say.
What is important is for us to be able to show over the months to come that the president's strategy is succeeding.
But Robert Gates has been one of those people that is reportedly hesitant about the war, not entirely 100% gung-ho. And now with us is Elizabeth Buemiller. She's Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. An article published in today's New York Times from Elizabeth Buemiller says that the administration is conflicted about the war in Afghanistan. Elizabeth, we have people within the administration arguing over what should be the strategy and whether or not they should be there at all.
Well, the argument, which the story I reported, I should say, is with my colleague Peter Baker, who covers the White House. The argument is not about the whether the war should continue. The argument is about the number of troops that should be added in the coming months, which is what that is the big debate right now. And there are some people like Vice President Joe Biden who are concerned about sending more troops into Afghanistan. Other people, like Hillary Clinton, we're told, and Richard Holbrooke, who is the chief envoy to Afghanistan for the president, are behind a larger troop presence. And Robert Gates is sort of in the middle, interestingly, as defense secretary. He's always been concerned about what he calls the size of the American footprint in Afghanistan. He has been in government for many, many years. He's served eight presidents of both parties. He's a former CIA director, and he always recites the case of the Russians who were in Afghanistan in the 1980s. They had a troop presence there of 120,000, and that we know what happened. They left the country in humiliation. And so, but yesterday at the press conference, to answer your question, he signaled that he was willing to consider more troops because of he's been impressed by the strategy and point of view of General McChrystal.
Who everyone assumes, although he didn't ask in his current report for more troops, everyone assumes he's going to ask for possibly up to 40,000 more in the weeks ahead.
That's true. No one knows exactly what he's going to do. I don't think there's actually a troop request on paper right now. The Pentagon is cautioning and saying, please, you know, don't assume this is going to happen. But the general consensus among defense analysts and people who advise McChrystal is that he will come in with three options for the president, what he would consider a low-risk, high-risk, and medium-risk option, low-risk being sending in more troops, as you said, perhaps as many as 40 to 45,000, medium-risk, people say, might be 25,000, high risk, that is the risk to the U.S. effort in Afghanistan would be, say, 10 to 15.
Quickly, Elizabeth Buemiller, do you sense any tension between Gates and McChrystal in Afghanistan, and broadly, any tension between Gates and the White House? I mean, Gates is a holdover from the Bush administration, not necessarily Obama's teammate here.
Well, actually, Obama handpicked Gates and McChrystal. Obama made the decision to keep Gates, and it was Gates is a Republican. You make a good point there, but he's a very moderate Republican to the extent that he's political at all, I would say. And he has given the president a lot of political cover first. Pulling out troops from Iraq, political cover from the right, I should say, and now, and he has always been very skeptical of a buildup. So, in fact, he's a very influential advisor to Obama right now, and by most accounts that we hear out of the White House, was very influential in the decision to draw down in Iraq, and also in the decision earlier this year to send 21,000 additional troops to Afghanistan. And also bear in mind that McChrystal is a handpicked advisor, as I said, because Obama and Gates fired the previous commander in Afghanistan, General McKiernan. They felt that even though he was requesting additional troops, he didn't have a real plan for
Elizabeth
how to use
Bue Miller is the Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. Thank you so much. Now taking a look at the news this morning.
Well, an important piece of economic data that we've been talking about all morning has just been released. The August unemployment rate is out. It's at 9.7%. Recession is alive and well. It's up from 9.4% last month. Arson is suspected in the huge California wildfire north of Los Angeles. As a result, a homicide investigation is now being launched in the death of those two firefighters killed in the blaze. The fire is now 38% contained, 10% more than yesterday.
Ximena is now a tropical depression, downgraded from a Category 4 hurricane earlier in the week.
Michael Jackson's private funeral was held yesterday. Mourners included Elizabeth Taylor and Barry Bonds, Macaulay Culkin. The Jackson family asked fans not to attend, but several showed up anyway. And those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
Coming up in just about 10 minutes, we'll check in with the latest violence in Mexico's drug war along the border. An attack on a drug rehab clinic has left 17 patients dead this week.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
And at breakfast yet.
It's Friday, so we, of course, are talking about film. And it's the Labor Day holiday, which
cinema.
Means a lot of people are going to be heading to the movies this weekend with their families. Joining us now to talk about what's coming out this weekend is Rafer Guzman. He's the film critic for Newsday. And, you know, many people love the movie Office Space, and they've been eagerly anticipating this new movie that's coming out, Extract. This is the new one from Mike Judge, and here's a clip from it.
You see that? They're not going to do their jobs. I'm not going to do mine. I'm just going to sit here.
So Office Space was in an office. This one's in a factory. What's new about this movie?
I think what's interesting is that this is told from the boss's perspective, whereas Office Space was told from the employee's perspective. Jason Bateman plays the owner of an extract factory, like a flavoring
like
extract
a
right, so
factory.
Right. So Jason Bateman, they've clearly got an empathetic boss, as where we, that was clearly not the case in Office Space.
Sympathy for the boss?
Sympathy for the boss, yeah, which is sort of unusual from Mike Judge. But, you know, the factory setting is really sort of secondary to the actual plot of the film, which is more about Jason Bateman's wife has essentially stopped sleeping with him. That's Kristen Wiig from Saturday Night Live. And so he's decided to hire a gigolo to sleep with her, which would allow him to sleep with the attractive new girl at the factory with a clear conscience. So the workplace setting in this movie is kind of not really that important.
Kind of that moral vagueness
HR
that Mike
nightmare.
Judge
yes,
is
exactly.
famous for.
Exactly.
HR nightmare there.
And supposedly in this movie we're actually rooting for him.
Yes.
To succeed in double adultery in his marriage.
Yes, sort of. And I don't want to give anything away, but the way that it all plays out is a little bit unusual by Hollywood's moral standards. So that I thought was a little surprising.
That's tantalizing.
That is. Yeah. Another movie that you weren't perhaps not quite so tantalized by was All About Steve with Sandra Bullock.
For Mary.
Mayor, your date is here.
He's hot.
It was love at first sight.
Hey, Mary. I'm Steve.
He's so not gay.
People want Sandra Bullock to succeed.
They
Does
do.
She here? Does she?
And she's generally great. She's generally very successful in comedies.
I think she is. I mean, she has had sort of a spotty track record lately. The Proposal was her last romantic comedy, which I think was not a huge hit for her. And this one, you know, I think Sandra Bullock can almost always, you know, bring out the charm in a character. But she really, really, there's just nothing she can do with this character.
You said this is possibly the worst film you've ever seen. That seems a stunning statement.
Worse
than Pearl Harbor?
I wasn't a critic when Pearl Harbor came out. But, you know, Newsday has a 4-star rating system. And when I filed this review, it was the first review that I'd given no stars to.
0 stars. Not even a half.
Not even. That's what my editor asked me. He said, "Can't you be gracious and give it 1 star?" I said, "Why? It's a terrible, terrible film.
Thumbless movie.
Is it bad enough that people will go to see it just the way you can't look away from a train wreck?"
You know, I don't know. It's Labor Day weekend. It's going to be it's a quiet season for movies generally. It's one of the only things out there that might have some sort of appeal to people. Sandra Bullock's, I think, still a box office draw. whether or not it's going to be enough to get people out there. And the reviews have generally been absolutely atrocious so far.
Okay, Rafer Guzman, he's the film critic for Newsday. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headley. Coming up, 17 dead at a rehab clinic in Mexico's border drug war. We're going to have an update on whether this means it's escalation, a shift in tactics. More on all that in just a minute. We're also checking in with you about the economy. Unemployment is up a little higher than expected, 9.7% from 9.4%. But those are the numbers. We want your story. Are you, your family, or your friends having good luck finding jobs? Are they getting more interviews, more job offers, or less?
My name is Dan, Westfield, New Jersey. I'm seeing that there are additional jobs coming up on usajobs.gov. Most of them are full-time, but there are some that are coming up that are part-time as well. I'm one of those dinosaurs looking for a job for the last 3 years, and I'm glad to see there are a couple of part-time ones that I might be able to take advantage of.
Well, thanks for calling us, Steve. That's the public sector, government sector. We've also talked about healthcare and stuff. What are you seeing in your sector? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. First, let's check in on today's top news stories. And nearly 100 are reported dead in Afghanistan after a NATO attack on militants in stolen fuel tankers. The airstrike triggered a massive fireball. Afghan President Hamid Karzai is now launching a special probe into accusations that many civilians died. NATO is investigating as well. Here's Captain Elizabeth Mathias.
They are indeed looking at the site as well as asking individuals in the area as to what they witnessed having happened and what evidence they do find on the ground.
Several top Taliban commanders are believed to be among the dead.
The Obama administration is sending new signals it may be open to major compromise on health care reform. Top advisor David Axelrod says the president supports certain core principles but is, quote, not dogmatic about how to achieve them. Some on the left worry this signals the president may be willing to approve a health care bill without a public option. Our partner, the BBC, reports the Israeli government could be on the verge of greenlighting construction of hundreds of new West Bank settlement buildings. A senior Israeli official says they'll be approved before any decision on a future building freeze. The Obama administration has pressed for a freeze, though. Protests are intensifying in China's west as ethnic tensions boil over. Police use tear gas to break up large crowds there today. And quarterback Michael Vick will be able to play in the third week of the NFL regular season. He welcomes early reinstatement.
I've been doing everything I could and just trying to do all the right things and make sure that I stayed on course, and I'm happy with the decision.
The league says it's reinstating Vic sooner because he's making progress. He was kicked out and put in jail on dog fighting charges. Those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
And now two quick live updates on stories we've been following, certainly, if not all year, all week. First, we just mentioned that the gunman stormed a Mexican drug rehab clinic in Ciudad Juarez, an industrial city across the border from El Paso, Texas. The death toll now stands at 18. Assassins lined up and killed 18 patients. Drug gangs have targeted clinics in Juarez before, but this attack was one of the deadliest since Mexican President Felipe Calderon declared all-out war against those drug cartels 3 years ago. Joan Griot is a journalist for Time magazine who's covered drug cartels and has actually been at some of these rehab centers in the border zone. He joins us now from Mexico City. Joan Griot, there's escalation here, even if there's not a shift in tactics. What's the message for combatants in this war and to people in these rehab centers?
Well, I think escalation is definitely the word here. Drug cartels have been using this kind of extreme violence now for several years of, massacres, beheadings, this kind of tactics to try and strike terror into their enemies. It's not just about killing, it's about spreading terror. But escalation is the word because, a couple of years ago, it might have been a big story if they walk into a place and kill three or four people. Now they walk in and kill, 17 died on the spot, and as you said, one more died in hospital. So the message is to any enemy of the drug cartels, we will kill you, and we want to spread terror in the population.
Based on your experience and your reporting, Joan Griot of Time magazine, how are these rehab facilities actually part of the drug war?
Well, the rehab facilities obviously house drug addicts and recovering drug addicts. on the streets of these Mexican cities like Ciudad Juárez, many drug addicts, as in the streets of the U.S. cities, many drug addicts have also been involved in the drug trade. They've been selling, they've been trafficking, often in lower levels, and on the streets, often coming from these same communities where the drug cartels are very present and have often organized gangs, affiliated gang activity in their neighborhoods.
How is this story being reported down in Mexico City? It's certainly another sign that Felipe Calderon, the president of Mexico, doesn't have control of the situation.
It certainly is. In a way, very sadly, Mexico has been so saturated with stories of violence over the last 2 years, it's very hard to shock people. And this, in fact, is taking less, in a way, having less profile than some other stories. And if you look at what happened last September, when celebrating Independence Day for Mexico, assassins threw grenades into a crowd of people. You've had the head of the federal police assassinated in his own home by drug cartel hitmen. With this level of violence happening all the time, it's very hard to shock people. And the public are just in some ways, have had an overdose of this.
Well, overdose, an apt word there. Johan Griot, Time Magazine journalist who's covered the Mexican drug cartels for quite a while, reporting from Mexico City on a situation in Ciudad Juarez, an industrial city across the border from El Paso, Texas. 18 dead after a cartel attack on a rehab facility. Thank you, Johan.
Thank you.
And in California, the station fire that burned through almost 150,000 acres north of Los Angeles week is now being called arson by officials there. And the death of two firefighters in that fire will now be pursued as homicide. Steve Julian is the Morning Edition host at KPCC in Pasadena. He's been following this story. Steve, arson, of course, means it was intentional. This was not somebody's campfire left unbanked, correct?
Oh, that's true, although sometimes it could be an accidentally set fire, and still there can be some negligence involved in an arson charge, and that could also result in a murder charge afterward if somebody dies during the commission of the crime.
What kind of evidence are they pointing to say that this is arson, if any?
Well, they won't say. They haven't arrested anybody yet that they've announced, at least, and so they're keeping the evidence quiet, keeping it close to the vest, although one person close to the investigation said anonymously that they found some sort of incendiary device at the point of origin where the fire broke out in the forest.
And with the death of two fighters, this again involves the homicide squad as well. Have we heard anything from the homicide squad about the pursuit of an investigation in this case?
They'll work in tandem with arson investigators and with the county fire department as well to find out what evidence they have and then pursue whatever leads they can find. Now, the fire apparently started at a turnout in the road up Angeles Crest Highway at mile marker 29. It's a few miles north of the city of La Cañada. But as far as what evidence they have, how they'll proceed, they're not talking yet.
And certainly since we don't have any evidence, we also wouldn't have any idea of what the motivation would be for starting this fire.
And that's very true. Whether there was a motive or not, sometimes these are accidentally set. Yet they found some sort of evidence, according to the anonymous source, that there was an incendiary device there. So that implies that it might have been intentionally set.
Now, Steve Julian, let's talk about that. Based on what they're saying, would the suspicion of homicide include the possibility of manslaughter, which would be a lesser charge? Or is it pretty much second-degree murder and above is all they're considering based on this evidence from this source?
Well, any time a crime is committed in California and somebody dies during the commission of that crime, the suspect, if arrested, can be tried for murder. Now, what happens when they get all the evidence and find out who the suspects are or suspect is and go to court, prosecution can decide how to proceed with whatever charge. So it would be premature to say how they'll head in that direction.
And I assume they're at some point going to try and pursue them to get some kind of monetary damages for the millions of dollars it cost to fight this fire, though I can't imagine them collecting that amount of money.
Steve, that often happens.
Steve Julian is the Morning Edition host at KPCC in Pasadena, giving us details on the station fire north of Los Angeles. It's now being ruled an arson by authorities. Steve, thanks for joining us this morning.
And 38% contained.
Yeah, so which I assume is only going to improve even further as we go through the days ahead. Economists have said are looking to the unemployment numbers. They're probably a little worse than they expected.
9.7% versus 9.4%. That's the jump from July to August.
Yeah, and some people were hoping they would either stay steady or maybe drop a little. It's got to be a bit of a disappointment.
Economists were expecting about 9.5%, but the markets don't seem to be reacting terribly much. Going to be positive open on Wall Street.
But I'm wondering how you're reacting to this. How's the recession in your home? Are you getting more jobs? Are you getting more job interviews? How's it going on with you? Here's one view.
I think we're actually getting out of the recession because of the fact that when I look online and I look at jobs that are appropriate to me, they're all of a sudden they're there, and they weren't for a while.
That's your takeaway from Francine Morin, a former hospital program coordinator in New York. She's laid off in February, still unemployed.
But she's getting nibbles.
But she's she's like optimistic. What's your story? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. By the way, it's the last weekend before summer ends. What are you doing to say goodbye? What do you regret not doing this summer, John?
Well, I'm going to find the last tomatoes, I think, up in my garden this weekend.
Oh, that's nice. Maybe make bruschetta. Tell us that, too, at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm Celeste Edley.
I'm John Hockenberry. You're listening to The Takeaway. Have a great weekend.
It's that time of year when the memories of summer wash over us in a sentimental haze.
Pass the sunblock.
We're not going to have a perfect healthcare system. It's a complicated system. There are always going to be some problems out there.
No compromises. No compromises. Senator Nugent now.
Do you know the difference between a lawyer and a catfish? One is a scum-sucking bottom dweller. The other is a fish.
It's unprecedented government intrusion into the private sector.
No compromises. No compromises.
We could be doing a lot better than we're doing right now.
On second thought, maybe some of us are glad it's over. Dog days or dog eat dog on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 4th. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry.
You know, I think what's cruelest about the summer is it's so short. You know,
it feels that way now.
Good morning, Celeste. This hour, we're going to take a look at those unemployment figures deep into the numbers. What do they mean for the recession? Also, a woman enters the race officially to replace the late Ted Kennedy's Senate seat. We're going to go to Cape Cod for an update. And what films are worth seeing this weekend? Where the Wild Things Are. Troubled movie? It's actually going to come out.
But first, Karen Temelty, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Karen, what are you watching for in this debate coming up next week?
Well, you know, Celeste, when the president stands there in front of the two houses of Congress, I think the one thing I'm going to be looking for is specificity. To get this debate moving, I think he's got to be a lot clearer about means as well as ends, that how he wants Congress to act.
Thanks, Karen. Stay with us. We're going to get more from you in a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, in the headlines, 9.7% of Americans are now out of work. That's a new report just out a few minutes ago. It's worse than forecasters expected. The August unemployment rate jumped from 9.4% to 9.7%. That's up. Nearly 100 are believed dead in northern Afghanistan after a NATO airstrike. The attack targeted a military convoy of stolen fuel trucks. Giant fireball after the attack. NATO says it fired only after determining there were no civilians nearby. But President Hamid Karzai is launching a special investigation into reports of many Afghan civilian deaths.
Our partner, the New York Times, reports deep divisions in the Obama administration over whether or not to send troops, more troops, to Afghanistan. We talked to the reporter last hour on The Takeaway. If you missed it, you can hear that conversation on thetakeaway.org. And the wildfire around the L.A. area, now a murder scene. Investigators say the giant blaze is an arson homicide. Two firefighters died when their truck tumbled down a mountain in that blaze. It's now 38% contained.
Here's an economic indicator. California IOU holders can cash them in. The state issued $2.6 billion in IOUs because of its deficit problems, but now they can be redeemed for real money. Quarterback Michael Vick will be able to play in the third week of the NFL regular season. That's earlier than originally planned. Vick was kicked out and put in jail on dogfighting charges. He's back with the Philadelphia Eagles. levels. Wall Street gained less than 1% yesterday. The Dow opens at 93.45 this morning. The S&P starts trading at 10.03 and the NASDAQ begins at 19.83. Despite the bad economic numbers, the markets are reacting positively. Looks like a positive opening when Wall Street gets going in about a half hour from now. So what are you seeing in your circle, economically speaking? 9.7% unemployment nationally. Tell us the story in your neck of the woods. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headley. And continuing now with Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Mentioned specifics there at the top of the hour with Celeste. Among the specifics the president will have to address next week when he addresses a joint session of Congress to talk about health care is the so-called public option. Karen, we had Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat from Wisconsin, on the show yesterday. And despite a lot of reporting, Feingold still seems to believe the president hasn't given up on the public option.
I still don't know. I am pleased that the administration has come back to talking about a public option after slipping there. And I'm watching this very carefully because we do need a progressive health care reform bill.
Now, Russ Feingold seems to believe that the administration might be even edging back to a public option. But if I click on your story, Karen, on the Time magazine website, you seem to suggest the option is just really off the table. Which is it, Karen?
Well, certainly everybody that I am talking to would suggest that it's going the other direction. Essentially, particularly now that in the Senate they're looking at needing a 60th vote, that 60th vote is going to have to be Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine, a very moderate Republican, who would like to see a public option put into the plan, not as part of the original plan, but only as what they're calling a trigger, so sort of a fallback if insurance companies themselves weren't able to produce the kind of competition it would take to sort of put some kind of pressure on health prices. And so I think that's a very, very, you know, weak option and one that is going to disappoint a lot of liberals.
And do you think it's going to be mushy like that when the president speaks, or is he going to say something very, very definitive next Wednesday?
You know, no one knows is the first answer, but there is certainly a great feeling among his allies that he needs to get more specific. You know, the president is right when he says that there's a lot of agreement on this bill, that essentially on 80% of it, everybody kind of has the same idea as what needs to be done. But this last 20% is really what blew up the summer. And it's not just the question of the public option. It's questions like, how are we going to pay for this thing? And who's going to get covered? How close to universal coverage are they willing to, you know, be satisfied with? If the president doesn't at least give us some clearer sense of this, I think this speech is going to be a missed opportunity, much like his news conference this summer was.
Well, finally, the agony of the health care debate is perhaps best represented by the story of Charles Grassley, who's a big friend of this program, who's come on this program and talked about his efforts to negotiate with Max Baucus in the Senate about health care. But he's out at this point. Quickly, why is his departure from the scene emblematic of what's going on here on the GOP side?
Well, no Republican in Congress had gotten more attention, more sort of tender, loving care from the White House than Charles Grassley of Iowa, because he's not only the number one Republican on the Finance Committee, but he was the one real hope, I think, the White House saw and that the Senate Democratic leadership saw of getting a significant number of Republican votes for this bill. And, you know, as he is showing increasing estrangement from this whole process, I think that hope is gone. They're going to have to do this basically on Democratic votes with possibly, you know, two Republicans from Maine.
Well, Karen Tumulty, that's great analysis. Karen Tumulty is the national political correspondent for Time magazine. Thanks for joining us. So we got Republicans, they're kind of out. You've got progressive Democrats. What do they think? You've got the Blue Dog Democrats, the conservative Democrats. What do they
think?
Right.
You've got a couple independents that were kind of wondering which way they're going to go. She was talking about trying to get the Democratic votes, and who knows how that's going to work if the public option is really off the table. We do have a Democratic congressman with us who can possibly answer that. Javier Becerra is from California. He represents Los Angelinos in the legislature. He's also vice chair of the House Democratic Caucus. The question is, I guess, do we get a public option or do we drop it? There's been a lot of noise about this lately. And this is what we heard from Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius last month, saying it's not essential to President Obama's health care plan.
What we don't know is exactly what the Senate Finance Committee is likely to come up with. They've been more focused on a not-for-profit co-op as a competitor as opposed to a straight government-run program. And I think what's important is choice and competition. And I'm convinced at the end of the day the plan will have both of those. But that is not the essential element.
So, Javier Becerra, you have come out very strong in favor of a public option. Are you willing to compromise on it?
Celeste, I think if you're looking to have meaningful reform of our healthcare system, you can't just put the current broken system on steroids by pumping more money into a private insurance system that has led a lot of people to have to drop their coverage because they can't afford it or never be able to get on in the first place. The only way you have real competition, which will keep prices down, is to have a real competitor in the market with those private for-profit insurers, and that would be a public option like Medicare.
But do you realistically at this point feel like you can get something passed with a public option included?
Oh, sure, because as you just said, it's just one option. No one has to select that option, just like no one has to select Blue Cross or Aetna as their choice. No one's being forced to go to any particular private insurer. No one would be forced to go to any public option plan. People would get to choose. Why government would want to limit the consumer's choices by immediately restricting the number of options out there is beyond me.
But the question isn't how the consumers will accept it once the bill has been passed, whether or not they'll be happy with their choices or not. The question is, can you get the 60 votes that you need? Can you bring a Republican into the fold or your two moderates in your independents? Can you get the votes that you need?
I think if they were made to understand what the public is beginning to understand, that the public's choices are being limited by those who are saying we must not have a public option in this reform bill. If that becomes the case, I think more and more we'll see members of Congress voting in favor of reform that would include any number of options and then let the consumers decide.
Well, Congressman, though, it seems like the numbers are going in the other direction for you. You represent the district in Southern California in the L.A. area. And your 31st congressional district. But broadly speaking, most people, 51%, are opposed to what they think of as Obama's plan for health care reform. And all the reporting seems to suggest that whatever the House passes, if it has a public option, the Senate will pass something without a public option. And in the conference committee, public option is going to be stripped away. Obama has walked away from you, it appears.
Well, I don't agree. I believe the president is fighting hard to get reform passed. But he himself has said to make this meaningful reform, you have to include competition that will give people choices and keep costs down. You can't do that if you don't have inserted into this reform a real plan that will compete and force others to compete to try to get business from the consumer at the best price.
But if you end up with a health care plan that does not include the public option, will you break with the president?
Well, I don't think the president has yet broken away from having a public option, but it would be difficult for me to believe that you can have meaningful reform of the system that will bring the prices down and help provide coverage to all Americans who don't have it, unless you have the options out there that really would create that competition. Why we would want to restrict people's choices makes no sense.
I assume that many of your views on health care reform are informed by your wife and her experience. She's an obstetrician, is that correct?
Oh, OBGYN, yes.
And she has probably helped you to understand kind of from the grassroots level exactly how the health care reform may affect your constituents. Are you hearing from the people of Los Angeles that they support the public option mostly?
I just did a telephone town hall the 4th of the month for me, and in asking the question about the public option like Medicare, about 70% of those who were on the line, it was not scientific, of course, it was those who were on the line, and I had some about 3,000 to 4,000 on the line at any given time, had said that they would support or wanted to see a public option within this reform.
Okay, Javier Becerra, very, very quickly, have you heard from the president details about the framework of his plan during this recess?
I spoke to him last week. We spoke for about a half hour, and he told me more about his principles and his goals and how he was hoping to get the support of members of Congress. We had a good conversation, and I believe what he's doing is trying to work as hard as he can to get as many members as possible to get on behind a reform effort that will be bought and sold by the Congress to the American people.
Javier Becerra is a congressman from California, vice chair of the House Democratic Caucus.
I don't know. Seems like they're going to walk away from that public option, and poor Congressman
Becerra
might be left in the lurch there. But lots to talk about there. Next week, of course, Barack Obama addresses a joint session of Congress. We'll get some specifics and have more to talk about then. Coming up, who will be most affected by the H1N1 virus? According to the CDC, it's not young children under 4 who are usually at risk. They're probably the safest, according to the CDC. More about who really is at risk and some concrete steps you can take to combat H1N1 virus in just a few minutes.
And we're also going to talk about the new unemployment numbers. They're higher than economists had predicted. Some dashed hopes this morning, I guess. We'll talk about what those numbers mean to you later on in the show.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, Michael Vick's dog days just might be over. He's back in the NFL. We'll explain with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen in just a second. But the H1N1 flu virus invasion is about to hit the beach here in the Northern Hemisphere. And anticipating that, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a report yesterday showing that children, normally the most susceptible to the seasonal flu, those under 4 years old, may actually be safest from H1N1. Accompanied by some other good news out of the CDC. And here to sort it out for us, as he often does, is Dr. Richard Wenzel, chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
So H1N1 is less dangerous to 4-year-olds and under who normally would be more susceptible. That was just one of the pieces of good news that Dr. Thomas Frieden, head of the CDC, said in Atlanta yesterday. First of all, for young kids, why might this be the case?
Well, it's a little bit unclear, but remember that what they showed was of the deaths so far, and they counted just under 500, about 15% were in children defined as young people less than 18. And of those deaths, 85% were in the young children, but older than age 5.
Hmm. So Thomas Frieden also said this yesterday in Atlanta, quote, "The good news is that so far everything that we've seen, both in this country and abroad," and I know, Dr. Wenzel, you've been abroad and seen both what's going on in this country and abroad, Frieden says, shows that the virus has not changed to become more deadly. This new flu, while unpredictable in nature, usually doesn't make people very ill. Is that good news, and should we take that to the bank?
Well, that's good news so far. This is a virus that loves to mutate, to change, and it could get more aggressive or even possibly less aggressive. So far, that's good news.
And, you know, I was even hearing yesterday that the CDC was making a comparison with the seasonal flu and that H1N1 isn't that much different from the seasonal flu, according to what the CDC said yesterday, although it's hard for me to interpret. It seems like there's a lot of conflicting signals coming out of there. What do you think?
Well, I don't look at it as the same as seasonal flu because the group that's affected most is unlike seasonal flu in a major way. Seasonal flu affects primarily the very young children, 1-2 years or less, and the very old, people 80 years with underlying lung and heart disease. But what's really happening now with H1N1 around the world is young adults, children and young adults being affected. So even if the rate is the same, the point is that young adults, many of whom have no underlying disease, are getting infected and seriously ill and some dying.
So that would mean we need to focus on junior highs, high schools, those groups significantly affected, you believe?
I do, yes.
And any specific precautions for those institutions, or do we just sort of sit tight? They're calling it a pandemic at the World Health Organization.
Well, I wouldn't sit tight. I think as soon as the vaccine's available, I believe it should be used widely if it's proven to be safe. Secondly, we have a good preventive drug. So if children are in high-risk groups, we have a drug that will, oseltamivir or Tamiflu, that will prevent 90% of infection in those just exposed recently, such as in a household or in school. And schools should be putting hand-washing facilities, whether it's alcohol or sinks with soap and water, available and encouraging that all the time.
Well, as usual, concrete, clear advice from Dr. Richard Wenzel of the Department of Internal Medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University, reacting to what looks like some good news yesterday out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention regarding H1N1 flu. Thank you, Doctor. And now, as promised, Takeaway contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen joins us. The big sports news this morning, of course, is the NFL has ruled, and as expected, Michael Vick, quarterback for the Philadelphia Eagles, will be playing as soon as the third game. What are people saying about his contribution to the Philadelphia Eagles?
You know, people are saying that he's not going to be a make or break for the Philadelphia Eagles season, but he's definitely not going to hurt them. Mm-hmm.
And the pressure is on after the third week, so we'll just have to see. We'll definitely be talking about how well he does or if he crumbles under the pressure.
More Wildcat offense for Philadelphia.
Right, indeed. So the U.S. Open is also going on, the tennis championship here in New York, and we may have seen the new face of women's tennis in the U.S. The faces of Venus and Serena Williams, of course, have been the faces of women's tennis in the U.S., but what are we starting to see now?
We have a woman, a young girl, actually, Melanie Udan, who actually beat Demetieva yesterday in a thrilling match. She won the third set. She's coming up. She's really coming up. She had an amazing Wimbledon, and now all of a sudden she's in contention. She's going to go against Maria Sharapova today for her next round of maybe another big upset.
And really, women's tennis has been looking for a new rising star. Here's a 17-year-old from Georgia. That was a huge upset yesterday in the second round. Third round gets harder, though.
Indeed, it does. And what she has in her corner is that she plays great under pressure. And with the crowd cheering her on, she plays amazing.
Well, she talked about that yesterday.
The whole crowd was cheering for me and so much support. And I was struggling a little bit with my leg and just, I don't know. The whole thing was just amazing. I can't believe I won.
She was struggling. She looked pretty good.
She had a Carrie Strug moment there with her injured thigh.
She did. She had a spasm in her leg, like a cramp, basically. But I think that and the crowd, I think that made her play better. She's young. She's got the energy. And she's going to be really thrilling to watch in the coming weeks, hopefully, if she makes it through.
Really quickly, we were talking about pennant races earlier. Suddenly, Derek Jeter, the New York Yankees, who look like they're going to clinch the AL East, although you have to see, Derek Jeter is creeping up on a pretty important record with the Yankees.
The record is, it would be the past Lou Gehrig for the most hits as a Yankee.
And that's a big number.
It's huge. I mean, there's guys like DiMaggio, Gehrig, Ruth, Mantle, Yogi Berra, the list we just created.
A lot of big hitters have played for the Yankees. Wade Boggs even was on the 96
Precisely.
Team.
Yeah. Don Mattingly, Dave Winfield. Derek Jeter is going to be the best one of them all. And that is a pretty big statement in this era of steroids, in this era of, you know, poor sportsmanship, that we have a guy who's led a club, he's played in the same team for his entire career. Derek Jeter will go down probably as one of the greatest Yankees of all time.
Give us an update. Dodgers, Rockies, San Francisco Giants, that's the most exciting pennant race. Where does it stand and who do you predict?
Well, right now the Dodgers are up. The Dodgers are in a good place to win it all, but I love the chances of San Francisco because they just pulled in Brad Penny, who was a defect from the Red Sox, and Penny is pitching great in the NL. So look for the Giants to make a push for the end of the season.
All right, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks so much. By the way, it's the last weekend before summer ends. What are you doing to say goodbye to summer? What do you regret not doing this summer? Tell us that, too, at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What are you doing, Celeste?
I'm probably going to sleep.
You didn't do enough of that.
I could use some rest.
Well, John emails us, let's agree to call the time from Memorial Day to Labor Day social summer or media summer. Sometimes some of the best days of summer are after Labor
That's
Day.
That's very true.
That's true. What am I going to do this weekend?
John continued on. He told us what he's going to do this weekend. He says he's going to get a new battery for his car.
Get Thy Neighbor's Wife by Gay Talese from the library. Get and watch Doubt. That's something else he's going to do.
Attend a barbecue for his sister Kate, who's going to China in 10 months.
All right. Well, we're talking about unemployment in just a minute. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. The August unemployment rate is out. The new rate is 9.7%. That is up from 9.4% in July. It's a little higher than what economists predicted. We're asking you where you stand in all of this. Many economists are saying the recession is ending, and yet we get higher than expected unemployment numbers. And 9 out of 10 people believe that the recession is still hitting them. So what do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're joined again by Catherine Rempel. She joins us via phone from New York. She's the editor of the New York Times Economics blog. Catherine, this is the highest unemployment rate for the U.S. since 1983. That sounds dire.
Yeah, that's pretty steep, indeed. And actually, it's even worse for particular groups as opposed to the overall nation. Like, if you look at the unemployment rate for teenagers, I believe it's at its highest rate since the government began collecting this data in 1948. So, yeah, it's still pretty bad.
That kind of goes along with what we heard from the Pew Research Center about how most of the job growth we're going to see in the next 10 or 15 years is going to be among older Americans.
That summer for teenagers.
Yeah.
Yes.
So,
absolutely.
So, you know, we've been hearing these things from economists about the fact that the recession is ending, and yet we get 9.7 unemployment. Which one is true?
Well, actually, it can be kind of confusing. The unemployment rate and other indicators of the labor market tend to sort of lag behind other parts of the economy. So generally, when an economy is reaching a turning point, you see changes in things like housing, consumer spending, business investment, inventories, those types of data points before you'd see it in the job market. So when economists are saying that they're seeing a bottom or we're out of the recession or they're expecting it to end soon, they're looking at the types of indicators that probably normal people aren't seeing in their day-to-day lives, that is, their jobs.
Which is probably why the CNN poll says that 9 out of 10 people think we're still in a recession.
That makes sense, yes.
Catherine, let's take a look at the public sector. If you break out the numbers, are a lot of the jobs that are still there being generated by government programs, like, say, the stimulus program? Is the public sector still strong?
Well, it sort of depends on what you mean by the public sector. From what I can tell, employment across the government fell in August,
wow.
Actually. I believe that it rose slightly for federal workers. But if you look at local government payrolls and state government payrolls, those numbers are down. The one industry, sort of super industry, that remains strong throughout all of this is healthcare. Mm. Month after month after month, we're seeing growth in healthcare despite the deterioration of pretty much every other part of the economy.
So, Catherine, at what point can we are we really expecting these unemployment numbers to drop?
It's very hard to say. You know, some economists I've spoken with have basically said they expect that we'll get into the double digits in the overall unemployment rate, maybe well into next year, and that this is, you know, one of those terrible cliches, a jobless recovery, that we'll, again, see other things turning around for a little while before people start to really notice it in their paychecks.
Okay. Catherine Rempel, editor of the New York Times Economics blog. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, John, there's a lot of rumors about who's going to run to fill Ted Kennedy's vacant Senate seat, maybe even Kurt Schilling. But
that's,
we know one thing for sure, Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley will run.
Today, I announce my candidacy for United States Senate.
That seems to change the tenor of the race there. Joining us is Frank Phillips, State House Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Frank, a lot of other people who may be interested in the seat are waiting to find out whether or not Joe Kennedy's going to enter the race. Martha Coakley obviously decided not to wait. But do we have anything more? Do we know whether or not Joe Kennedy's interested in this Senate seat and whether he's going to run?
We know he's interested. He's thinking about it. Whether he will run or not, that is the big question. And everybody's on the edge, wondering whether they're going to get in this race because of Joe Kennedy. He would be a powerful, political force to get into it and have a great impact on it.
But Martha Coakley is a big fish in Massachusetts. I've covered her, actually, and she could actually keep Joe Kennedy out. I mean, you've got a combination of Rudy Giuliani, the prosecutor, and Hillary Clinton, the sort of big fish. Describe her a little bit.
Well, she's a very attractive candidate. She's very good on the stump, very articulate at press conferences. But frankly, she's never been, had been tested in any race she's run. She's run for Middlesex District Attorney, Middlesex County District Attorney, and really had no opposition. She walked into the Attorney General's office with literally, I can't even remember the Republican, if there were one, who ran against them, her. So I think this is a big if. Can she hold up under a high intensity race, one that's going to require a lot of scrutiny and a lot of agility on her part, and a good campaign staff? She hasn't displayed that yet. So she does, she being the only woman will be a very formidable candidate.
And that could play a role here. She was a major supporter of Hillary Clinton's and involved in that campaign in Massachusetts. Is she kind of counting on Hillary's voters to come to her side?
Yes, very much so. I think there is a very strong women's vote. I think a lot of women would like to see a U.S. Senator from Massachusetts. And I think that that's a very strong point. And a lot of the men who are, who are thinking about getting in the race will not get in the race if there are too many white males in there, and that's what is lining up to to get in, and they're not going to get in with just one woman in there, and she would have a distinct advantage with that.
You know, as we said before, many people were waiting to hear from Joe Kennedy before they threw their hats into the ring. Is there still a sense that this seat should belong to the Kennedy family? That if Joe Kennedy runs, he has the right to take that seat?
Well, I think it's more that, you know, that he has a lot of resources to go by. One, the Kennedy name, yes. There's a strong feeling and sentimentality, particularly after what we've been through in the last couple of weeks, and that this is a Kennedy seat. There is that feeling, but he also has a lot of resources. The Kennedy fundraising ability is, you know, is nationwide, and he does have some pizzazz and charisma. He also has some problems. He could be very clumsy, too.
Yeah, so we may see Martha Coakley as a strong contender there. We were here with Frank Phillips. He's a State House Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. And, John, if Martha Coakley does come into this race as a strong contender, she's been pretty active in healthcare in Massachusetts. It could change that debate.
And it might be the Ms. Squeaky Clean, Martha Coakley, versus maybe not so squeaky
the
clean
smudgy.
Joe Kennedy. Yeah, smudgy. I like that. Kennedy smudgy. Let's check in on some of today's top news stories.
Investigators say arson caused the huge L.A. area wildfire. The fire is 38% contained now. Americans with relatives in Cuba can now send them unlimited cash and visit the island for as long and as frequently as they want. This signals an easing in the nearly five-decade-long trade embargo.
Do you have relatives that send you unlimited amounts of cash?
I would like those kind of relatives.
Nice. That'd be good. Eagles quarterback Michael Vick got some good news. He's going to be allowed to play football this month. He won't have to wait till October. Vick missed two seasons while serving an 18-month prison sentence for operating a dog fighting ring. Those are just some of the top stories we're watching today. Reminder, unemployment rate's at 9.7% for the month of August.
That's correct. Coming up, summer, great time for blockbusters, but for the really deep films, you need to look to the fall when they're contending for Oscars.
Transformers. More Transformers.
We're going to get a preview of what films you should watch in just about 10 minutes. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. You may recall there was some significant global reaction to the release of that convicted Lockerbie bomber, Mr. Abdul Basid Ali al-Magrahi, who was released from a Scottish prison and returned home to Libya. But to get a sense of what's going on inside Libya in the aftermath of the release of al-Magrahi, earlier we talked with Rana Jawad, North Africa correspondent for the BBC, and asked her to react to this clip from the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, who describes how offensive the release of Magrahi and his reception in Libya has been to the people in the United States.
This is a very raw and sensitive subject for all Americans, and how President Gaddafi chooses to comport himself when he attends the General Assembly and the Security Council in New York has the potential either to further aggravate those feelings and emotions or not.
Rana Jawad, we've been told that the reception for Magrahi in Libya was warm, if not a hero's reception. What was it, from the perspective of someone actually inside Libya? And is there much talk in the reporting inside Libya of Muammar Gaddafi's impending trip to the United States to attend the UN General Assembly?
Well, I think there's no doubt the perspective seen from the West was that of a hero's welcome for al-Megrahi when he arrived to Tripoli. But as far as the Libyans are concerned, they saw it as quite a normal reception. The officials have said that, you know, a lot of the people that were there were belonging to a youth organization or association that were also marking Saif al-Islam, Colonel Gaddafi's son's reform policies, and the rest of the crowd consisted of his tribe, of Megrahi's tribe, and they said, you know, they tried to control it, but they couldn't. However, knowing, you know, Libya and how things work here, you know, spontaneous gatherings don't exactly take place on a regular basis here. So clearly there was a lot of control on who was allowed onto the tarmac to greet him. Now, and as far as Colonel Gaddafi's upcoming trip to New York for the UN General Assembly, it's not been reported on locally in news outlets here. It's all state-controlled media. They don't usually preview visits of that kind. But obviously, there's a lot of talk about it. Clearly, there's a lot of concern coming out of the United States as to what Colonel Gaddafi may or may not say at that meeting, because he is due to deliver a speech right after President Obama does. And, you know, Colonel Gaddafi does have a tendency to go off on a tangent, if you will, when he speaks, particularly when addressing a large crowd. His speeches are never scripted. He likes to inject a long history lesson, if you like, into whatever topic he's handling. So come the end of September, when the UN General Assembly convenes, it's all up in the air. I don't see how anyone can control what is said.
Rana Jawad, quickly before we go, certainly Gaddafi has benefited from the release of nuclear information and the discontinuation of the nuclear program that happened during the Bush administration. Any sense that he's worried about losing this sense of being embraced by the the world leaders, the international community? Any sense that he's worried that he could have a setback here?
I don't think that there's any sense of worry, because as far as the Libyans are concerned, they know they are an oil and gas-rich country. They feel that they have the upper hand in the negotiating process in that sense.
Well, having oil and gas gives you the upper hand in those kinds of negotiations. Rana Jawad, North Africa correspondent for the BBC, joined us from Tripoli, Libya.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, fall fast approaching. What movies are going to have you going to the movie theater? We're going to get a preview on the fall movies in just a few minutes. We're also checking in with you about the economy. We heard out that the unemployment numbers are up to 9.7, but we want you to report on what you're seeing. Are you getting more job interviews? Are you seeing more jobs available? What's going on at home? 8778-MY-TAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And first, we'll check in on today's top news stories.
Well, we've got fresh economic news out just this morning. 9.7% of Americans are out of work as of last month. The new unemployment rate is a boost from the previous 9.4% in July, and it was worse than predicted. Nearly 100 are reported dead following a NATO airstrike in northern Afghanistan. Warplanes targeted militants driving stolen fuel tankers. The gas-fueled explosion was massive. There are reports of many civilian deaths, and NATO says it believed there were none in the area before firing, but regrets any possible civilian deaths. And the attack is now under investigation by NATO and the Afghan government.
UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown says British troops should stay in Afghanistan until local forces can handle security.
We will have succeeded when our troops are coming home, because the Afghans are doing the job themselves.
Brown's speech from just a few moments ago, it comes as the war is increasingly unpopular in Britain. Investigators are now treating the wildfire zone around LA as a crime scene, ruling the cause arson. That means the two firefighter deaths there are now considered homicides. Teams are starting to box in the fire. It's now about 38% contained. And a top White House official may be signaling willingness to drop a government-run plan from a health care overhaul. Top advisor David Axelrod says the president supports certain core principles, but is, quote, not dogmatic about how to achieve them. That's kind of vague, but enough to make some liberals nervous about the so-called public option. We may get some more precise details from President Obama when he speaks to a joint session of Congress next week. That's some of the top stories that we're following.
Let's go out to dinner and
go out to dinner and see a movie.
So conventional wisdom tells us that during the summertime, we're only willing to sit for about an hour and a half to see one of the great big blockbusters. But fall comes around, we're getting geared up for the Oscars, and we'll sit through more thoughtful films, more cinema, as John would say. We're going to hear about what's coming up.
So public radio.
In the movie theaters, Rafer Guzman is film critic for the Newsday. He joins us again. We've also brought in Karina Longworth. She's the editor of Spout blog to talk about what's coming up. And there's a number of kids' films coming out, but many of them are not necessarily only, solely, or even mostly aimed at kids.
Is that parent killers, I guess, is the idea, right?
Yeah, I think
parents can see them.
I'm a relatively good indicator. We've got Where the Wild Things Are coming out. This is based on the famous book from Marie Sendak, and I probably want to see this movie at least as much as my son does.
Yeah, I think it should be really interesting. And speaking of the grown-up factor, it's directed and co-written by Spike Jonze, who was famous for Adaptation and Being John Malkovich. Dave Eggers, who's, an extremely popular author. He's also one of the screenwriters. It's got Catherine Keener is playing the mom. It's got a really hip soundtrack with the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs and Arcade Fire on it. So I think a lot of things are shaping up to make that not just your normal kids movie.
So, Maurice Sendak actually was involved in the writing of this script, and this is what he had to say about the film.
There will be controversy about this, but the film has an entire emotional, spiritual, visual life, which is as valid as the book. He's done it like me, whether he's done it or not, but in a more brilliant, modern, fantastical way.
I'm sure there's people who aren't ready.
I can't tell if he likes it or not there. I can't really. It seems like there's a little faint praise in there. I don't know.
Maurice Sendak, well, you're the eternal skeptic.
I don't know.
John. Maurice Sendak talking about the film. Karina, do you think there's going to be controversy about this film?
I don't know if controversy is the word that I would use. I mean, best case scenario is that it goes over with both adults and children. Worst case scenario is that nobody gets it at all.
And Spike Jonze and Dave Eggers aren't exactly known as being like whimsical sort of funny guys.
Right, but that might fit Marie Sendak's tone, the tone of the book, which does have kind of a somewhat dark tone. So that it might actually be a good fit.
Arguments. Warner Brothers kind of wanted to lighten up. Spike Jonze supposedly won that argument.
It's been a very troubled production. We'll see whether or not he won, but both sides have basically been, saying very nice things about each other in the press lately. So.
Well, there's a couple other films coming out that are aimed at children that maybe don't have a guaranteed audience. Astro Boy, that's based on the Japanese anime character, and also Fantastic Mr. Fox, that's based on the Roald Dahl, with some very famous voices doing these. Let's talk with the Mr. Fox, because it's not necessarily an animated film. This is stop action.
It's stop motion, yeah, which I think is really unusual and interesting, given that so much of the stuff that these days is computer generated. And I think what also makes this interesting is it's Wes Anderson's very first animated feature, and Noah Baumbach is the screenwriter who wrote Squid and the Whale. Mm. So again, there's a hip factor going on.
Yeah. But here we see Meryl Streep yet again. Can this woman, is there anything she can't do? Meryl Streep and George Clooney and Owen Wilson and Bill Murray. I mean, the cast of voices in this is star-studded.
Right. Two of which are longtime favorites of Wes Anderson, Bill Murray and Owen Wilson both. I think it sounds really interesting. I think George Clooney seems, from the trailers, like a really good choice for the role, which is a very sort of smooth operator kind of a role. Mr. Fox is apparently sort of a family man living in the animal community. But he apparently is a bit of a chicken, has kind of a chicken habit, and he has a relapse that sort of brings him in trouble with the farmers, which sounds really funny. And so the rest of the film is about him trying to get himself out of this situation.
But Karina, again, with this film, these names, these big name voices, aren't going to be bringing the kids in.
No, they're designed to entertain an older audience. And I think with a Wes Anderson film, I mean, his films have never necessarily been super adult in their themes anyway. In general, his characters are sort of arrested children, so I think this fits really well.
Well, Karina Longworth, Antichrist comes out this fall. That's got to be for chuckleheads, right?
Antichrist is a really interesting film. It's arguable that there is no audience for it, but if there is, it's definitely an adult one.
Well, you got Charlotte Rampling, you got Willem Dafoe.
Charlotte Gainsbourg.
Oh, really? Okay. So have you seen the film?
Yes, I have. I saw it at Cannes, and the version that premieres here may be slightly cut because the version at Cannes was extremely sexually graphic and violent. But Apparently, it's going to be shown here almost in the exact same version.
That's not the only, at least, semi-horror film coming out. We've got The Road, also Viggo Mortensen and Charlize Theron coming out. Rafer, what are we expecting from that one?
I don't know. That one's been pushed back. That was, I think, originally supposed to come out last year, if I'm not mistaken. But that's a post-apocalyptic drama. It's based
great
on
book.
The Cormac McCarthy book, right? You know, no lighthearted author.
No.
He. And I don't know too much about the story, but the trailers make it look pretty intense.
And of course, very much talked about in coffee shops and other places. We've got the follow-up to Juno from Diablo Cody, but it couldn't be a larger departure.
Right. Jennifer's Body, you're talking
yes,
about,
exactly.
The horror film. Yeah, which looks very interesting about the sort of high school hottie who's actually apparently killing her boyfriends.
Jennifer's evil.
I know.
No, I mean, she's actually evil, not high school evil.
So this isn't exactly pure horror. There's a little bit of comedy in there.
It seems to be. There seems to be kind of a self-winking referentiality to it. But I have to say, I think Megan Fox is a brilliant cast for that role. We all know her from the Transformers movies, of course, and she seems like an ideal choice.
It feels like kind of Freddy Krueger meets John Hughes a little bit.
It kind of reminds me of Heathers, Heathers. So I can't let you guys go without mentioning something about the new Disney movie coming out, because this is highly anticipated, especially by those in the African-American community, our first black princess, although John Disney doesn't want us calling her black.
That's correct.
Only African-American.
They got to you too, I see.
Yes.
No, she's only our first black princess.
She's got to be an animal for most of the movie, right?
I mean, pardon me for being cynical, but we had The Lion King with African-American voices, and now we've got this one where she's the first black princess, but she's a frog.
She's a frog for most of the film, apparently. Yeah, I know. Disney has taken a little bit of flack for that so far.
I think they're going to take more.
They may well. I mean, the film, whatever happens, will certainly be a talker. That's for sure.
Thanks so much for joining us. That's Rafer Guzman. He's a film critic for Newsday. We also heard Karina Longworth, editor at Spout Blog.
Maybe that's what they should call the movie, Talker. Disney thinks so. Talker, the princess, Talker, Talker princess. That's great. I love those guys. The unemployment numbers are out. We should remind you before we go into the weekend here, just a little depressing news before we close out the summer, a little higher than expected, 9.7% for August, up from 9.4%. But forget the economy. Just bail.
Forgotten.
It's Labor Day weekend, right? So we want to know what you think about the last weekend before summer ends. I mean, it's unofficial. Summer still actually goes to the 21st of September, and we're thankful for that. But what are you doing to say goodbye? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hi, my name is Ben Goldman, and the one thing that I regret not doing this summer is finishing my dissertation on time. I'm just not going to make that end of September deadline, but I'll keep working on it.
Thanks so much for sharing that with us. What did you not do this summer that you regret? Johnny emails us, I didn't go swimming in the ocean, though I swam a lot in Lake George in New York State. I hope to get in the ocean before the warmer water disappears. I love the ocean.
And they're going to have more ocean in the Arctic, although I can't imagine he's going to want to swim in it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. See ya.